This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the October 26th edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, Puppets Who Die. Busting out of southern Alberta, the collective Old Trout Puppet Workshop are currently touring their dark comedy, Famous Puppet Death Scenes. They join me live in Studio Q. Plus, M. Griner, a string of critically acclaimed records, beloved by Bowie and Bono, the pop singer-songwriter from southern Ontario, is our Friday live guest, playing throughout your podcast. This one goes out to Scranton, Pennsylvania, home of The Office. Dwight Schrute, this is for you. This is Q. Let me introduce you. M. The musical journey of M. Griner has been quite an adventure. 9 years ago, she released her debut disc, Public. Since then, a critically acclaimed string of albums, collaborations with everyone from David Bowie, which I'm very jealous about, to Def Leppard, founding her own record label, and now a visit to Studio Q, as if this is the crowning achievement. She's done Bowie, but now here she is in Studio Q, where she's sitting at our grand piano. Welcome, Em.
Thank you. You're not jealous that I played with Def Leppard, are you?
I think that's kind of cool, but Bowie is, I almost don't want to talk to you because you had the chance to tour with Bowie. You're going to start with playing us a song on the piano, and then we're going to chat later in the hour. What are you going to play for us?
This is a song called Blackwing Bird.
Nice. This is off your latest record, the record that came out this last year, The Summer of High Hopes. This is M. Griner playing live in Studio Q, Blackwing Bird.
Thank you. soar on my way, as sad as the state of things we can't change, sad as the state, sad as the state of things we can't change.
That's M. Griner playing live in Studio Q, the song Blackwing Bird from her latest album, which is The Summer of High Hopes. I'm so glad you played that song. I think that's my second favorite song on the record.
Really?
Yeah. I really like Almighty Love. But, I mean, I like, it's a beautiful song. Is there anything you want to tell us about that song before I ask you about it? There's this lyric I want to ask you about,
I wrote it after seeing the movie 13, so it's kind of inspired by the coming of age. I'm just ripping off other people's stories, basically.
right. Well, there's a long tradition of doing that. Like every artist has a certain degree of that. Real girls don't take aim like kings do these days.
Oh, am I supposed to dissect
that? I don't know. There's a lot of, this record, there's some gender talk on this record. That's girls versus boys in some cases, or girls and boys discussions. And I was curious about that line.
Or girls behaving like boys.
Right.
I don't know. I think, I'm not really an expert on gender issues, but I feel like there's quite a bit still to do on the, I don't know. I feel like we're still a very corporate world, kind of run by men still. So I don't know. It's a bit of a commentary on that.
Oh, I was wondering if it meant that you think girls are less vindictive somehow.
Nope.
No. Well, that's probably a good thing, because I would have challenged that. Wait a minute, I know some girls who are vindictive. You are up to a lot of things these days, are you not?
It's been a busy year, I'll say that.
You're the kind of artist who comes in and we sort of sit around with the great Q producers and go, okay, well, what can we possibly, where do we start with M. Griner? Do we start with the potential new radio show? Do we start with the last record? Do we start with a new tour? Do we start with a new record that's come out? Do we start with Dead Daisy Records, which you own and control and manage? Where would you want to start?
Wow, I don't know. I do want to say, though, that it's great that you have the show, and I did get asked to co-host a CBC radio show, and it's a lot of hard work. And the way you do this live, it's not a walk in the park. I'd just like the listeners to know that.
Right. Next time they complain about the way I say things.
Right. That's the end of my compliments for you, though, today.
I've known you for years. That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. That's miles into the nicest thing you've ever said. Let's talk about this radio show, because I understand you're going to be hosting a radio series in the near future with Danny Michelle,
yes.
Canadian singer-songwriter, about the art of the cover song. So tell me about that.
The show is called Under the Covers, and it's not to be confused with Between the Covers, which is a book show that everyone knows very well. Danny and I have both released covers records, whether we wanted to or not. We have that in our history. So we are approached by CBC to co-host a show. So we've taped about half of those shows, and it'll air in the summer.
You've done two records of cover songs
in
your career, one of loud guy music and one of Irish music. What do you think makes a good cover?
Well, it's a good question, because that's something we do talk about on the show. And I personally, I love it when someone changes something entirely to make it their own. And, no one wants to hear just a replica of a song that's already been done. I mean, maybe some people do, but I don't. So,
do you always like it when somebody makes it entirely their own? Or do you sometimes dislike it when it's an artist in a song that you really like and somebody else is doing a version that you potentially can't stand?
There's that. I mean, there's some Joni Mitchell songs I don't think should have been touched. But anyone who kind of has the guts to turn it around, I really kind of respect that. So.
I've said on this show, for example, that I don't think anyone, with all due respect to Danny Michelle, who I think is an incredible singer-songwriter, because he did an album of this, but I don't think anyone should cover Bowie. Mm. I'm enough of a Bowie fan And I'm willing to, there's some exceptions. I mean, there's in other languages, potentially. and sometimes with Bowie involved, with the, you know, Bowie and the Arcade Fire, there's one or two, there's some exceptions, but I just think he's too valuable an artist. The songs are too interesting. And when somebody takes a song like Heroes, as Jacob Dylan did in The Wallflowers, and ruins it by doing their version of it, I get angry. So I think it's tough. It's walking on eggshells with people like me out there when you take on covers, right?
Right. Do you know something really surprising? It came up while I was working with David about The Wallflowers cover, and he really liked it. And has that ruined everything for you now that I've said that?
Well, now I know I can't, even Bowie and I aren't on the same side on an issue. But he might have liked it because the royalty checks were starting to come in because it turned into a hit. I don't want to think of Bowie that way. I'm sure he doesn't think about money ever, right?
Never.
Well, how did it come up with Bowie?
I don't know how it came up, but we did perform Heroes, and it was interesting that song was almost too big for some of the venues we were doing. We were doing quite small venues at that time as a promo tour. And I've never experienced that where you play a song and it's too huge for the room. And I think it just came up that he liked their version. And I'm not sure about this. I may be a beacon of misinformation, but I think that he may have even performed it with them.
I don't want to hear any more about this.
You're going to ask me to leave now.
Well, probably. No, I just you're crushing me. I feel it's almost like Bowie's engaged in infidelity with me or without me. How does that work? Infidelity. You did this album of covers of modern Irish music. Songs of Love and Death. This came out a couple of years ago. I wonder how this went over, how it was received in Ireland.
Well, it's interesting because I took a lot of songs that if you grew up in Ireland listening to music, you would look at my list and be extremely confused. You know, everything from Thin Lizzy to The Undertones to The Virgin Prunes to The Corrs.
The
Thrills. But for me, I just took songs that I thought, you know, I could do an interesting take on. So it turned into, if not a commercial kind of success, something that a lot of journalists and media started to talk about. And it opened the door for me to put out my own album there. So it worked out. Everyone went home happy.
Does working on covers, besides opening the doors in a business sense, does it help your creative work? Do you feel?
It totally does. I mean,
also,
you must know this as a musician, just when you learn someone else's song, you suddenly realize all these other patterns of songwriting that, you know, I grew up with a very conventional view of pop music, and to learn someone else's song and realize, you know, they went here, they twisted something around, it just makes you more brave with your own music, I think.
I've got lots to ask you. We still have some time in the next half hour to do that. But I do want to hear you play another song. What were you going to play for us?
I'll play the song that you like.
Oh.
This is your show.
Not just me. This is apparently the song that Mr. Bono likes as well, right?
Mr. Bono Vox.
I don't know. Yeah, Mr. Bono.
Do you think anyone calls him Bono Vox?
I don't. He was originally Bono Vox, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Then he shortened it.
Just
sell out. Almighty Love. Yes, I'd love to hear you play that. From the album The Summer of High Hopes, M. Greiner is walking over to the grand piano in Studio Q. Thanks for... Were you going to play this or are you... No, I'm touched.
Yeah.
Oh, you were going to play it. Oh, forget it. Almighty Love.
Start that again.
No problem.
Horrible. Okay, can I just start?
Do you want me to intro it again?
Yeah.
Playing live in Studio Q, this is M. Greiner, Almighty Love.
Promise to
Playing live in Studio Q. That's M. Griner and the song Almighty Love that appears on her latest record, The Summer of High Hopes. I think that is my favorite song on the record.
Thanks.
But, and I guess I'm just stealing the idea of somebody else, which is this song caught the eye and ears of a very famous modern Irish songwriter in a publication strangely called Q. I don't know where they got their name from. This was the song that that Bono called one of his desert island picks or something. What's the deal with this?
It was a song that he chose. It was a 20th anniversary edition of Q magazine, and various people were asked what their favorite songs of the last 20 years were, and he named it as one of his 6 favorites.
And that must have been interesting news for you.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I thought maybe people will stop asking me about Bowie then.
Look, you can't work with Bowie and then come on the show and expect to not be asked about Bowie. All right? I will ask you about Bowie for the rest of our lives, no matter what show I'm hosting, where I see you on the street, no matter what happens. But can I ask you about Bono then?
Sure.
Has there been some follow-up? Have you ever talked to him?
You know, I met him. It was very briefly. I met him in Dublin one night because he's out and about all the time and very kind of low key. But yeah, we talked about the McGarrigles and Montreal, and he has a real affinity for Canada and Canadian music.
You're gonna play another song for us?
Sure.
Something classical?
No.
Oh.
This song is an uplifting number called All Time Low.
All Time Low. M. Griner on Q.
If drugs helped you and I'd black out together now, the soul last century, and if the rain could stay pressed against the heavens now, sun would say we were lucky. My torch would wonder with the great lakes in your eyes. They've stormed the slumber. Got loads of gold. We're at an all-time low. We couldn't have dreamed this cold. Where everything down.
Bumgriner performing live in Studio Q. That's the song All Time Low, also on her latest album, The Summer of High Hopes. It's nice to hear you play these songs solo. That song is something of a rocker
yeah,
on the album.
Things, like,
you know, there's a little distorted guitar, drums, and it's nice to hear this version. This record came out about a year ago. You're working on a new record, are you?
I just finished recording a new record. Happened very quickly this year. I wrote all the songs in the first part of the year and then recorded it through the summer.
We're experiencing that weird thing when somebody sits at the piano and I don't actually go over there with them, which is that we're speaking to each other, but we have our backs to each other.
It's a very special connection we have.
So we say something, then turn around to see if the person's looking, and by that time they've turned around and they're sort of speaking in the microphone. Where do you go from, when do you record the record and when can we expect to hear it?
Well, I finished it this summer. It's being mixed right now. I worked with a Canadian, actually, a guy named Greg Wells from Peterborough.
Mm, yeah.
Word up. And
part of the Greg Wells-Rob Wells dynamic duo.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. He lives in L.A., has a studio there, so we finished that. And hopefully it'll be out next year sometime.
Well, we look forward to that. Currently, the record is called The Summer of High Hopes. And it's available on your own record label, Dead Daisy Records. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
This is Q, the podcast. Let us know what you think. Send us an email at q@cbc.ca.
Once upon a time, in a cold, heated cabin in southern Alberta, huddled together against the frost, there was a group of rebel puppeteers. Yes. The band lived together and performed puppet plays for neighboring ranchers and Hutterites. They called themselves the Old Trout Puppet Workshop. This is a true story. And I also played Slough. These are all true stories today. Then in 1999, the Puppets emerged from the woods to become one of the most celebrated new theater groups in Canada. Their latest show, Famous Puppet Death Scenes, is exactly what it says in the title. 22 scenes that always end in the death of a puppet. It is somewhat macabre. It's a genre and mind-bending mix of German kids' TV show, sci-fi, barnyard devastation, pathos, and more, all framed behind the red velvet curtains of a traditional puppet show. Since the show's premiere in 2006, it has toured across North America and will continue to tour Canada well into the new year. Two of the Trout team join me in Studio Q, Judd Palmer and P2 Kendris. Welcome, gentlemen.
Why, thank you.
Thank you.
Very good to have you here, and I'm glad you've turned up in your overalls today. The last time I saw you was right after your show, which you prosecute in full sort of mourning suits, in black suits, right? I guess to mark the death of the puppets throughout the show, Judd?
Yeah, and to hide in the shadows, to fool the audience into thinking that the blocks of wood are moving of their own volition.
Right. No one sees you when you come out pushing the puppets.
Right.
This is a really fascinating story. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating show, but take me back. How you guys all got together, what drew you to puppeteering and in southern Alberta? P2?
Well, we actually were involved in a troupe before this, a troupe called the Green Fools, and at the end of grad school, for myself, we all just sort of disbanded, and it was a great sort of void for us.
What were you taking at school? That's grad school.
I did a sculpture degree, a master's degree in sculpture, and after which I moved back to Nova Scotia. And Judd went down to his family ranch, and he wrote this beautiful email to all of his friends and said, I feel empty, and I want us all to band back together and make something beautiful. He had gotten us a very small grant, just enough to really buy the materials for making a show. And then
had Judd proposed puppets at that point?
Yeah, we had worked a little with puppets previously.
So Judd, you put the call out.
Yeah.
This is in your family's farms in southern Alberta, is it?
Yeah.
And you said, come join me in southern Alberta.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Well, I mean, part of the whole thing was motivated by apocalyptic terror, right? Because Y2K was coming down the pipe. And I had...
motivates a lot of things.
Yeah, it does, exactly. And so we thought, terror, you know, yeah, it's a good place, right? If we run out of food, then there's plenty to eat. If we need, right, if we need, you know how it is, southern Alberta, if we need guns to defend ourselves against roaming marauders on spiked motorcycles or whatever. We're good to go.
Sure, yeah.
And also, I had moved to Toronto actually to try and be a television puppeteer, and had realized that was not my calling,
not in the offing. Right?
Yeah, no. I mean, it was doing it more or less, but you know, it was motivated by things that were shown to be shallow in the light of the looming apocalypse. You know, like I thought, I'll move to Toronto because they got really cool parties there. Everybody's got really cool shoes. And that's where I'll be. Then I'll be cool like them. And then I realized that, you know, if the world was going to end, that it would be better to
You are an Alberta boy.
Yes.
So in the face of potential prospective apocalyptic terror, you sequester yourselves with your friends in southern Alberta.
Yeah.
And so now these puppets that you start to create, I mean, I've seen the show, and for people who have across the country, they certainly don't look like Casey and Finnegan. How would you describe these puppets that you created?
Well, we always try to sort of make up the right puppet for the occasion, right? So in this show, because it's, 22 of the greatest death scenes from, the greatest puppet shows throughout history, we got to choose whatever style of puppet that we felt like. Like, we're not marionettes or something like that.
No,
we're more like, punk or primitive than that.
There's some scary puppets. And some friendly puppets.
Did you find them scary?
I've got a couple of them.
Yeah.
There's some European puppets.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. There's the whole schmear. Some of them are made out of rubber. Some out of heavy chunks of wood.
And this show, I mean, it's sort of a multidisciplinary show. There's the puppets, but you also combine acting and sculpture. I guess that's where you come in as well, P2. And yet puppetry generally is sometimes dismissed as a lesser art, children's entertainment. Why do you think that is, P2?
I think it has a lot to do with this. Often the puppetry that you see on TV, I mean, there's the long tradition of children's puppetry on TV, and it's sort of a decline in puppet theater in North America. Where there in Eastern Europe, there has been a strong tradition of puppet theater that has maintained to this day. But there has been some pioneers in North America lately, Ronnie Burkett and such, who have elevated it to a higher theater form. And it is odd because a puppet is both a sculpture and a painting, as well as a theatrical device. And, it engages all those artistic practices.
Now, the show is very funny. But it is the underpinning of the show is this series of death scenes where these puppets unfortunately die sometimes in the most aggressive of ways. Judd, why did you want to focus on the death of the puppets?
I think our objective in some way was to make a show that was not at all funny, that was also really funny. You know, to create that that friction between. Emotions that an audience member gets when they see a puppet dying. It started because we were doing a Pinocchio. We were doing a family show a couple of years ago, and then we wanted to do the old-fashioned Carlo Collodi one, right, which has Jiminy Cricket in it. But he gets murdered right off the bat. Like he doesn't occupy the sort of superego role with little Pinocchio. Pinocchio is like a hobgoblin, not an innocent, and he destroys the cricket in the moment that he shows up to scold him about something. And so we thought we'd do it the proper way, and we just watched the audience go through all these crazy emotions. Like, they were shocked, like, could they really be doing that? And then they started to laugh, and then they were sad for the little guy. And, you know, so we just wanted to see how much emotion we could pack into one blow of the hammer.
Really a bit of a dissertation on death by the end of it. I mean, we've watched a number of different death scenes. I would guess that you guys seem fascinated by the idea of death. Would that be correct?
For me, it's I actually just learned this new German word a little while ago, and it says it all to me. Like, it describes my particular psychological condition. Check this out. It's Torschlusspanik.
Torschlusspanik.
Torschlusspanik. It's anxiety produced by the sense of doors of opportunity slamming shut around you. Isn't that beautiful?
Well,
kind of. Yeah,
sounds like a tube station as well. But yeah.
Yeah, it does that.
I'm not good at my German yet.
Yeah, fair enough. But so it's in a way, I don't know. This is my own particular obsession. You know, every birthday happens, and you realize, well, great, you know, now I'm this age, and it means I'm never going to grow up in Paris or like the Olympic
That's because you've buried yourself in southern Alberta afraid of the apocalypse.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's the thing. Yeah, but you had to choose somewhere, right?
And
so it's this doors of opportunity.
And has this been cathartic for you, working your way through your own feelings about death with your puppets?
Yeah, it certainly has been. Yeah.
I mean, the show is funny. It's sort of a setup, but it's also very tender.
Absolutely.
And I think that feeling that transition in the audience is powerful to me. you know, and it's an important time and place for me right now in my life, and you know, my mother is ill, and I feel like I'm doing the right thing at the right time, and I do feel like people walk out of that theater feeling slightly better about the prospect of dying.
Well, you know, you don't put up any disclaimers to warn people about what they're about to see. I wonder if kids come thinking that they're about to see a puppet show and are ever disturbed or surprised by what they end up seeing.
Is there any severing of heads, for example?
Well, there's severing of heads.
Yeah, there's severing
of heads. And limbs.
Yeah. We got it all. All the limbs get severed, yeah.
De-skinning.
There are disclaimers, actually. Children.
Oh, there are.
It's generally in the...
Is it small print?
It's kind of small print. Yeah. But occasionally children will come. And, I mean, this is a great question that we were just going over with this guy that came to the show a couple of nights ago and then wanted to talk to us afterwards. And he's a guy that helps people in the real world die, right? Like, he helps them through that process.
Grieving?
A counselor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, not the
actual people dying.
The actual people dying, okay. Right? And he had a lot to say about the show, about the responsibility that he thought we had to actually help people go through this, because he thought that there was an empty place in our society about understanding how we go about living in such and which had to do with a full consciousness of the fact that we were going to die, right? Mm. And he talked about how it was actually very important, in particular for children, like that they aren't shielded from that information, that it was an important part of growing up in other cultures to be initiated into the knowledge of our own doom, so that you don't end up feeling like when you do die that you were just ripped off, like that, you know what I mean? That it was the great rip off, but that actually it's important to know that and to live with full consciousness of it, as opposed to be shielded from it.
There's a fine line to walk, though, right? That's a lot of territory you're trying to cover from entertaining the audience, bringing humor absurd situations and graphic situations with puppets, to the pathos, to the educating element. It's a tough task. Sorry, I'm just thinking about that. and wondering if you were going to respond, but
we don't engage in this puppet theater in a passive way. It feels like a bit of a mission, you know. The shows take a lot of our energy and time to build, obviously, and a concentrated effort of many people's lives, and it becomes almost like a mantra, and you know, we push ahead with these things and feel, by the time the show is up, fairly sure about what we're putting out there. So
you know, I was thinking when you were talking about the puppets and the different, I should let the listeners know, these are fictional death scenes, or these are puppets that you've created, and I wondered about that decision as opposed to, for instance, having Lamb Chop die, which would, you know, or puppets that we might recognize. Why did you decide not to do that?
I think because we got intrigued by the idea that, well, that it would be fun for the audience to imagine what this great puppet canon would be, you know, so that we could present a given scene as if you'd been, you know, parachuted into a 14-hour-long Norwegian existential, you know, theater of the insufferable production right at the climactic moment. Like, you don't have to wait there for the 14 hours, but you know, who is this guy? Why is he being, you know, devoured by wild animals, and why is he shrieking the name Linda, or, you know, or whatever? And so in some ways we thought that was fun as a notion, and then we also wanted to subtract as much sort of extra plot as possible and see how succinct an event you could actually make on stage.
I assume that you're going to tell me that, as actors, that you can take liberties with using puppets that you could not doing other kinds of theater.
Yeah, they can die night in,
night after
out.
Night.
Yeah.
Right. They can be disfigured.
Actors are much harder to dismember. Yeah. Or to fire out of cannon.
But even in storyline?
Yeah, well, the audience is generally much more readily accepting of, say, violence and, you know, with a puppet, because it is an object. But, you know, it's still a moving object. You still see the symbol. You get eye contact, you know.
Are you surprised by the cult success that you guys are having with this?
Shocked.
You shocked?
No, we were destined to be stars. It was only the very beginning.
Did you have a sense that it would take off the way it has? I mean,
No, not at all. It is true that it.
What do you think? What do you think is fueling the cultish nature of the fan base?
That's a good question, John.
Not thought about that, huh?
No, I haven't really.
It's a good thing.
No.
You see that? You think about that, and then you learn how to capitalize and monetize it.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the capitalist world, Judge.
Yeah.
The apocalypse didn't come. Capitalize on this now.
We're still here. No, in some ways, I guess we felt like it was a good idea because it sounds like it's going to be fun, so it'll get people in the door, right? Like, this sounds going to be stupid and entertaining in some way, but that it was also a vehicle through which we could actually try and make some real point, you know, speak from the heart, as it were, and so as a kind of a concept, we felt like it had strength that way.
Now, there's an upcoming video that you're doing with Feist, is that right?
That's the big plan.
It's in planning. Well, how is this coming about?
Well, it starts back with back when we were all in our early 20s back in Calgary, and Leslie was a punk singer and into puppets like we were, so we'd hang around and talk about puppets. So we've actually been planning to do a puppet Leslie Feist co-production for like 15 years.
That's a good time to do it now, boys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're gonna give it a shot now. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. There's some cleverness there.
Well, it's a pretty good timing to work with Feist at this point. So, are you talking about a particular song, or can you tell us anything? Where is it at the planning?
The plan is to do "Honey, Honey," which is off her most recent album, and it's the most melancholic, miserable, puppetish song on the album, and so. And it's evocative of kind of, you know, dreary, nasty, foggy places.
We look for it. Don't you want to do a video with the puppets, Em?
I wondered if the puppets might be in multicolored jumpsuits.
That's no problem. Because underneath our overalls, actually, we're wearing multicolored jumpsuits.
The puppets are open to dressing however they need to dress to make it on MTV. Before I let you go, we've talked so much about Alberta. I understand you guys have actually lost your studio in Calgary, and now you're moving to Mexico. Am I reading this correct?
This is the big plan, yeah.
For our next production, we're going to spend a few months building in Guanajuato.
It's a hard
Guanajuato.
Word.
Guanajuato. You can say that German word, sure. When it comes to the Mexican words, not so easy, huh? Why Mexico? What's going on?
Partially because we're working on Don Juan.
Oh, okay.
It's a romantic place to go, and why not Mexico?
Yeah,
maybe a good place to avoid the impending apocalypse.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, well, the outskirts of Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah. I've gotten into a relationship with a Mexican, you see, and so we've also been doing a lot of traveling around down there. And Guanajuato was the coolest town that you've ever heard of.
It's a pleasure speaking to you both. I know you're headed. You've got a few more shows here in Toronto. Then you go to Columbus, Ohio, and then. Later in the fall, you're doing Whistler, Kelowna, Edmonton, so people will get a chance to see more of you, right?
Yes,
before
indeed.
You go to Guanajuato.
Guanajuato.
It's a pleasure, guys. Thanks for coming on
the
show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Judd Palmer and P2 Kendris are two members of the Old Trout Puppet Workshop. Their show, Famous Puppet Death Scenes, continues at the Young Centre for the Performing Arts in Toronto through the weekend. And as I was saying, in the new year, their cross-Canada tour continues with stops in Whistler, Kelowna, and Edmonton.
You've downloaded Q, the podcast with Gian Gameshi, highlights from CBC Radio 1's daily cultural magazine, and I am not Gian Gameshi.
Lust Caution, the new drama by Brokeback Mountain director Ang Lee, opens today. It's had a huge critical response and big box office in Asia, where it's already playing. Among the movie's stars is Joan Chen, one of the best-known Chinese women working in Hollywood. She had early success as a teenage actress in China, then left Shanghai for L.A., and she had success there too, but her first roles were often the stereotypical parts available to an Asian actress in 80s Hollywood, the exotic femme fatale. Well, Joan Chen finally got some meaty roles, starring in Bernardo Bertolucci's The Last Emperor, then David Lynch's Twin Peaks, and Oliver Stone's Heaven and Earth. Now in her 40s, Joan Chen has reestablished herself in Chinese cinema, both as an actress and director, most notably behind the lens for her 1998 film Xiao Xiao, The Sent Down Girl. Joan had multiple films in the Vancouver International Film Festival this year, which just happened a couple of weeks ago, including her turn in the excellent Ang Lee drama Lust Caution. What a fantastic film this is. A few weeks ago, I caught up with Joan Chen from Vancouver. I was here in Studio Q along with a few members of the band The Sky Diggers, who you'll hear off the top of our conversation. Here's what Joan Chen had to say.
It's good to be here.
You could tip the gender balance by being in our studio here, though, because there's three male guests here. And
oh, I like that.
Okay. Why is an established actress like yourself willing to take a supporting role in an Ang Lee film?
It's because it is an Ang Lee film. I do it for Ang Lee. You know, I basically agreed to do it before even I read anything or knew anything about what this story is.
Really?
Yeah.
What does he mean to you?
Ang Lee and I, we've known each other for a long time. You know, he wrote The Wedding Banquet, basically tailoring for me to star in. But back then he couldn't find money. And throughout the years I watched his career grow and really loved his films and excited for him. And finally, you know, we bumped into each other at a party in Shanghai, of all places, after not seeing each other for like close to 10 years. And that's how this job came about.
And you agreed to do the film without even knowing what the film was.
Yeah, we came down the elevator together from the party, and I noticed him like staring at me. It was a little uncomfortable. I was like, what is he doing? And then the elevator door opened and we said goodbye. He hugged me and said, oh, Joan, you know, I want you to be in my next film. And I was just elated. And then he looked at me and said, well, Joan, the leading lady is a very young girl. So I knew that it is a supporting part, but I still wanted to do it. I direct myself, and it would be a great experience to be on his set.
And it is an absolutely mesmerizing and gripping film.
Yeah.
I guess you were pleased when you ended up reading it to find out the story. Both of you, Ang Lee and yourself, you straddle two cinematic worlds in China and America. What is that like?
I think it's wonderful. And I noticed that his learning curve is so steep, I think, because of it. I noticed on the set of Lust Caution how he combined the spontaneity and casualness of the Chinese filmmaking with the more systematic, more organized, structured way of Hollywood filmmaking, as well as the crew on the set, you know, international, multilingual, everybody bringing in their different styles, adapting it to each other.
What do you mean by the spontaneity and casualness of the way Chinese film is made?
You know, there are little quick tricks that comes by experience, like, oh, you know, we need reflection from gems, and they would think of just wonderful ways to achieve this goal, but without spending any money, and it's spontaneous. And also, it's not very organized. It's usually a very family style thing. You know, the disorganization can be awful for filmmaking because you can waste a lot of time. And the Chinese filmmaking is that way. It's not the most organized. And departments cross each other. In the U.S., in the Hollywood system, departments are very strict. And so all the departments can work together to achieve something.
You left China when you were quite young.
Yeah.
Why have you returned to make films there?
Because I think the Chinese film business is really getting at the cusp of having a great leap forward right now. And also, I'm at an age right now that I actually right now specialize playing mothers mostly. And it's just they're better written.
Beautiful, young-looking mothers, by the way.
I also play old mothers. I play old mothers when I was 30. So, and they are written with more depth and more beautifully from Chinese scriptwriters. And, you know, I can't be anybody's mother, just anybody's mother, in Hollywood movies. You know, they would have to find a son and a daughter that is also Chinese.
Lost Caution is something of a political film. And it's what's it like now to return to making films like this one that look politically at China?
You know, I look at it less politically. I think this is one of the most political writing by Eileen Chan. Usually her writing's not political. But the thing that attracted me to her works is usually this intriguing battle between men and women. The philosophy behind her writing, according to herself, was that it's timeless when it's everyday small mundane things. And when it's a big superhero or a big political background, it's just for that time.
Right, right.
But she didn't know. I mean, this one is quite timeless.
And it's actually set some 50 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, conspiracy is so central to this film. Everyone watching everyone else in China, in Shanghai, in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. Is that true of you? Do you have any sense that you're being monitored as you've made films there the past few years?
You know, I grew up. My first film, I went to the studio since I was 14. And so this is my second nature. It is my second skin on my body that I'm performing, that I'm constantly performing, and can't sometimes tell myself which one was me and which one was the performance. And it is very true for the film that we perform to actually find our true selves. Everybody in the film, every character in the film is putting on it. Act. And I think for my part, Mrs. Yi, you know, she is probably the most fluent performer in this film because she has been performing much longer. Her husband's serial infidelity has been part of her life. And I think for that era, Chinese women of her class status, the only thing they can do is to learn to play the game of marriage very well. I think if you could play the game of marriage, then you have a life.
But you've had to play the game of of film in both China and in the United States, and and it's not always been easy for you in terms of your relationship with China and the films you've made, right?
But it's interesting. You know, when I made Shosho, I was banned. First, they said 2 years. When I didn't write myself criticism and when I didn't pay the fine, it became 3 years. And so after 3-4 years, I realized that they were not going to forget it. I was hoping they would forget it because there were other people filming illegally and other people breaking the law. But they weren't going to forget the fact that I made Shosho. And so I went back and I paid my fine and I wrote myself criticism, and now I'm able to go back and work now.
You alluded to the roles available to you in Hollywood and the kind of roles that are usually offered to you. When you first arrived in America, after starting at 14, as you mentioned there, at the age of 20, you came to America. What was the toughest thing about transitioning from being a Chinese actress in China to being a Chinese-American actress?
I had to start from zero. I mean, I was the darling of the country when I left China. You know, I was on every calendar, you know, on everybody's desk, my photographs. But when I arrived in the United States, nobody back then knew of China, of anything about China, let alone seeing any Chinese films. And so I had to start from the very beginning of going on my first audition. And that was very scary because coming from a Chinese culture, especially back then with some traditional and a lot of communist education, you would have to be really modest. And going on audition is against that modesty, is to tell people, see how great I am, how pretty I am, I can do the part. And that was everything against my belief. And it was very, very difficult. And also when I did go on my first audition, I was very puzzled because they didn't think that I was Chinese enough, and I was fresh off the boat. And so I didn't understand what their Chinese
was. They want you to be more Chinese.
They wanted me to be Chinese. And then I slowly realized when I saw the other girls, you know, how they wanted the eye makeup to be and how they wanted the hair to be. And there's certain demeanor associated with their Chineseness. And I had to learn that. I had to learn to be a quote-unquote Chinese doing my auditions.
You've talked in the past a lot about the stereotyping in terms of the roles that you've been offered and being seen as a kind of Asian beauty. Is that still true now? I mean, not the part about being seen as an Asian beauty. I'm sure that's still true. But has the landscape changed at all?
Well, you know, now I wish to be typecasted as an Asian beauty at my age.
Well, I was speaking to one of the Asian actors from Heroes, and he was saying that he really thinks it's changed in the last few years because you have somebody like Masioka and Heroes, but you also have just Lucy Liu from Ally McBeal, and it's just in the last few years it's made a difference. Do you feel like there's cause for optimism in terms of the stereotyping around Chinese American actors?
There are a lot more opportunities today than compared to 20 years ago. That is for sure, but it's still limited. Especially for immigrant actors like me. I don't do the whole Americana as well as, for instance, Lucy Liu. I don't fit in that kind of character. And so that is still a little bit limited. I think it is better, though, because especially when China is now on the world map so much more than before, and it is economically, politically a lot more important and more genuine interest there is to understand China, to understand Chinese people. Mm-hmm. And so Chinese cinema as well as Chinese performers are having a better time today than compared to 20 years ago, yes.
Bernardo Bertolucci, the director who gave you your break in The Last Emperor, once said you seemed somehow in exile. Do you think that's true?
Especially back then, I was somewhat like that.
Yeah. Do you still feel that way?
I now can go back to China to work, so I feel less that way. But I was this princess in exile when he met me, that was for sure.
It's great speaking to you, and it really is a fantastic film, and I wish you the best of luck with it and all the other films you've multitasked into it that are all at the Vancouver International Film Festival this week. Thanks, Joan Chen.
Okay, thanks, Gio.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Joan Chen in our Vancouver studio. Make sure you can catch her in Ang Lee's excellent new film, Lust Caution, today in wide release across Canada. Incidentally, Lust Caution has grossed over $8 million in Taiwan and Hong Kong alone since its release. You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.